English. Used to, if she wanted to express a situation, she would say, that's the goodest thing there is. So this is the goodest part of the convention to me. When I was asked to chair this meeting, and this gal knew that I was going to chair it, she started out by telling me that she was going to write the introduction, that she was afraid I wouldn't do justice to her. So she started to write it, and about this time I got a letter from the committee. And they said, we ask that you remember that the chairman chairs and the speaker speaks, so I won't be able to use that. I want to reassure the committee. I know they're a little bit nervous about the two of us up here. We made a pact that we're going to remain the same, the sweet little old ladies that we've always been, and we're not going to embarrass you. She and I, the fringe benefits of this fellowship, other than looking out and seeing these faces, and I always have to express gratitude for where I am today and where I've come from. I love all of you. But this gal has been real special to me. I met her in the early 1970s in the fellowship. We share two unique titles, and we share a lot of titles, but these two I have to share. This roundup committee a few years ago was activating a committee to take care of speakers when the person that was assigned to chair them maybe couldn't get here, and they kind of needed somebody that gabbed a lot. And who do you believe they selected? It was Ruth and I. They needed to put a name to this title, and somewhere they came up with Mouths of the South. You know, I didn't have any trouble understanding why they named her that, but this little old me, I mean, a mouth of the South. The other child we have is we were withered within 6 months of each other. So over the years, we spent a lot of time together. Those of you that knew our husbands, they were the bleeding deacon, southern gentleman type, sitting out with their ties. I have a mental picture this morning of those two guys at the big meeting in the sky looking down and saying, oh my God, there they are, center stage again. And what are they going to say about us? It is a real pleasure. I have to get serious a minute and say that it's such a pleasure for me to introduce Ruth. I've seen her grow through pain over the years. I've shared that. She's seen that with me. The best way she did tell me, she didn't write out all this stuff. She said, don't say nice things about me. Isn't that just like an Al-Anon? We don't know how to take good things being said about us. So the best way I could describe her without taking any more of her time is to tell you that I give you a very classy lady and a very good Al-Anon. It's my pleasure, and I thank the committee for asking me to chair this. I give you Ruth from Birmingham.
Thank you. I think the committee said to her, chairman's chair and speakers speak. I knew she was going to do part of the speaking. You did too, didn't you? It's so good to be here. My name is Ruth Stewart. As she said, I belong to the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. The Best of Al-Anon family group is my home group. And to prove it, they're still up a line right over there, and I'm grateful that they're here. Thank you. Only thing, you have to watch them. If I pause, they're liable to come up and tell my story too. So I'm grateful this morning. I am just really filled with gratitude for this opportunity to be asked to speak at the Gulf Coast Roundup. I don't do this very well. I talk a lot, and I do better just eyeball to eyeball and knee to knee. But I owe a debt of gratitude to the Gulf Coast Roundup that I will be repaying for many years, a debt of love. And I can't imagine any place I'd rather be this morning than right here. It is good to be here. I will not call names, but I'm so grateful for the opportunity when they asked about a year ago if I would speak. I thought, they're not talking to me because you said I was on the Gulf Coast Roundup for years and I never got anybody locally. They went to California and wherever you people came from. And so, you know, their confidence has grown in me and I'm grateful for this. I need to tell you that it started for me. I probably will just ramble all. Oh, let me tell you something real funny. This is why they call me the mouth of the sound. A couple of years ago up at Simatonga, which is one of my favorite spiritual retreats, I backed my big fine automobile into a lady's big fine automobile up there, and And the husband was mad and didn't say very much to either one of us, but this was an old lady that I backed into that morning. And we got out and did a little bit of talking, and I said, don't worry about it. My insurance will take care of it. I had no resentment at all. And this morning I walked up to my next door neighbor in the motel, and we were down here, and I said, do you know somebody named Peg Chumbly? It's okay, isn't it? Where's Peg? Here she is. It's okay to break the anonymity because John's going through this afternoon. I'm trying to look at this girl. I thought she was old and ugly. And look at her. She's plain beautiful. I've been looking for her ever since I had her. My insurance took care of it, but you know what they did to me then? They made my insurance premium $700 for my wedding. I think Peg tried to warn me against this. We talked a lot on the telephone, and I am grateful that I found you, Peg. Thank you. A lot of things come full circle. If you stay around now and on in AA as long as we, a lot of us do. I'm going to have to express gratitude this morning for Fred, who is not here. The Gulf Coast Roundup was simply one of his finest things that he did. And you will find out that he did not have a whole lot of sobriety. But somehow during the years from 1973 on, I think he came to the first one, he managed somehow to have enough sobriety to run the coffee room over in Panama City. And there was somebody here that asked me yesterday from way down in Florida what happened to the little man that used to run the coffee room. You know, he gave a lot of credit to this roundup for his sobriety. And I did too, because I knew whatever happened, he was going to be sober enough to run that coffee room, and I was going to be down here acting like an Al-Anon. You heard me say, acting like an Al-Anon. This started for me back in 1972, October the 23rd, and I claim November is my gratitude month. Oh, I am grateful for this program, for you people, for the love, for the concern, and throughout all the years, and for, you know, keeping me straight and saying, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth, for God's sake, to retire here in your talk. I'm grateful for this. On October the 23rd in 1972, I really sort of had reached the bottom in my life that I didn't know how to get out of. I had been married for more than 30 years to a social drinking AA. He was socially drinking when I married, which I didn't know, and I found out later on. And I thought I had had about all I could have in this life. I just wanted to stop this merry-go-round you call life and get off. I didn't want to be here anymore. God had turned his back on me. Everybody had turned his back on me. Nobody wanted me around, and I didn't want to be with them. Things were really bad in my life. I walked down to the beach. We have a little beach place out in Panama City. We've had it for a long time, just a little trailer out there. But it's serenity to us, was to us. I walked down to the beach and sat there all night. I told you I wanted to get off this merry-go-round. I wanted to get off this thing called life. I just wanted out of it. I didn't know where to turn, and I didn't know what to do. But I sat there. I don't know what I thought about, and it's not important. It's just important to me that I don't have to go back there anymore. Early the next morning, I picked up a book that said, I looked at it. I do read a lot. I looked at this book, and on the flyleaf it said, in grateful acknowledgement to Alcoholics Anonymous for the use of your 12 steps, and gave a minister's name. I don't know that this is conference approved, and I've never asked if I could do it, but this is my opinion. It was very necessary for me to see this. A little light bulb sort of turned on. I didn't hear any bells and lights flashing. But a little light bulb sort of turned on because in the middle 1960s, somebody came to my door, two men, our door, and took Fred to AA. And I thought they belonged to the Ku Klux Klan. I didn't know where they came from, and I knew nobody would have much to do with him. And that's where I thought he went for a long time. We weren't communicating. We weren't talking. He was doing his social drinking and his thing. And I was at home reacting and raising the family. I'm grateful that he was taken to AA. I don't know that they do a whole lot of this anymore. But I am grateful that they were there, and I found out later who they were. But on this particular morning, I came back up to the beach. He did not have any driver's license at that time, and he had to ride when I said ride, because he didn't have any other way to go. So I said, we're going back to Birmingham. He said, all right. He didn't give me any problems. Now, he was this kind of drinker. He drank as long as he could drink, for as long as he could take it. Then he was sick for a week, for as long as he could be sick. And then he was remorseful for a week. And I tried years to plan the weddings, the funerals, and he loved good funerals. I hid the obituary column for years in our house. And I couldn't plan all these things in the time he was remorseful. And it was getting next to me. You know, you just can't hardly plan these things. This is the way it was. He said on the way back, I made a telephone call when I got back up to the beach house. I'm grateful for this. To the AA answering service, I never had heard the word Al-Anon. I knew about everything else going on in the social world out there, but if I heard it, I turned it off. He never asked me to go to Al-Anon or AA or anything with him. I finally found out he was going to AA, and he managed 9 months of sobriety. I didn't like him during this month of sobriety. I didn't like him when he was a year sober and drank again. I never liked him till he allowed this program to take him, and he began working on his character defects exactly like I worked on mine. And this was his idea as well as mine. He always said, be sure to tell that sobriety is not just the cork in the bottle. So this is the place I was that morning when I said, let's go to Birmingham. And I said, no, I made the telephone call first. The man that answered the telephone call was Bob, out on the beach. And Bob said, where do you live? So I told him, I didn't know what to ask him. I just made the call. And he said, well, we don't have any alcoholic ladies out there, but I get Joe to stop by and see you and get his wife to come by. And I didn't want anybody else down there to see what was going on in his family. And so I said, oh, no, thank you, and I just hung up. All of you know that Bob owned the motel right at the end of the beach where I lived. Joe lived across in Phillips Inlet, and neither one of them here today. They both still live in. They always accuse me of being the alcoholic in the family. And I just went on out and, just drove on away. Just drove on up to Birmingham. I have to tell you before I forget it that Joe's wife was my longtime sponsor till about 2 years ago in her death. God makes no mistakes. Absolutely. Petey was a hard-nosed New England Al-Anon, and it took that for me, and I'm thankful for it. Came on back to Birmingham, and Fred said on the way back, we're going to an Al-Anon, to an AA meeting, and I said, oh. He said, you can go with me, and I thought, oh. So I went in, and I didn't dress very nicely. And I thought they were all drunks, and I wouldn't go down there in my best clothes. I might get contaminated. And Fred was all dressed up in his suit and his tie, and I went back and put on my best bib and tucker, because we hadn't been anywhere in years together. We'd stopped making funerals and weddings and all these other things. So that I walked in this AA room, and I have to tell you, AAs, one and all, thank God for the reaction. Nothing on your face when somebody's been gone 10 years. It's just, welcome back. We're glad to see you. And you know what? I walked in that room that night with him, and there was a couple of fellas that I used to work with over there in the corner of the room, and I thought, oh, God, what am I going to tell those people? Scoop and Tom, how am I going to tell them what I'm doing here? Well, I thought they were going to come and speak to me. They passed right by me, and they put their arms around Fred, and they said, welcome back, Fred. These were the same two men that had told me some 30 years before that, you better not marry Fred. He drinks too much. And I didn't listen to him, It was from this point that I found Al-Anon in a beautiful way. This is the beginning of what happened to me. I'm going to back up and I tell you that I didn't wake up one morning and look over there and say, this old boy is alcoholic. And I'm in this family disease, alcoholic. Is alcoholism called alcoholism? And I'm reacting to it. That was a sorry old boy over there drinking, and I had done everything I could to get him sober at this particular time. And he once told me that if I would sleep in black nightgowns, he would not drink. And I bought a wardrobe of black nightgowns, and he kept drinking. It does not work. He did tell me one time that if I would shut up, that he wouldn't drink as much. Of course, I didn't do that. I never tried that, so I don't know whether that would have stopped him or not. But I know, and you know, that he had to make up his mind to stop drinking. I made it to Al-Anon, and I'm so grateful. when I got there, I have to say that I was sick and tired of me. I didn't like me. I couldn't live with me. And all this had happened at the beach, and I still didn't like me. There was no answer to anything in my life. And so I made it to Al-Anon, and I think I went to Al-Anon for me. And I am so glad I did, because it was years and years and years and years before he ever got sober. If that had gone for him, I would have been disillusioned one more time. But in an Al-Anon room, I saw people laughing. White-headed old ladies laughing, no less. And I thought, they're crazy. And you know what they did next? They got up and read the steps to me. And you know, you can look at me and tell how intelligent I am. I could read. And I had a big resentment, but let me tell you what they did to me. They were planning their first anniversary. They were not a year old. And they were asking for volunteers to make the punch. And I volunteered, and they didn't let me. Did you? They've let me year after year after year after year. I think we celebrated on the 17th, maybe last year. So I have made punch in that group time and time again. This is the beginning for me. It is the beginning of good things happening. But I have to tell you where I came from. And I wish I could just stop right now, because I look like a lady. My mother tried to raise a lady. But I'm going to have to tell you some of the things I did, and then you'll have to judge for yourself. Alcoholism is an illness. I got sicker than anybody else. Right up here on the stage, we were comparing notes, you know, and we said that this bunch of AAs over there that caused us to get here, you know, that we operated cold sober in the things that we did, and they operated under the drug alcohol. But we still had to sit in the basement and have our meetings. Didn't we, John? AAs have always been center stage pig and Ruth. One way or the other. I didn't start out to be like I was. I was grew up in a small southern town with three older brothers with no alcoholism. There was a whole lot of drunks in this town, but I didn't know to call them alcoholics. My brothers drank, and they partied, and they went to work, and they went to church, and they went on their dates, and we had eggnog, and I had my brothers make some homebrew one time, so I'm as guilty as anybody else. They were making homebrew, and they told me to watch for Mama, and if she started through the woods, that we'd all run off and leave this homebrew stuff. And they had me bottling the homebrew, and I was sipping the suds, because I had to pull the bottle cap down on it, and I'd get it too full. Anybody know about homebrew? I heard Mama slam the back door, and we knew she was headed for the path down through the woods, and they jumped up and left me, and Mama caught me sitting around in the homebrew, and she said, "Ladies, don't get drunk. Ladies, don't." Now, she whipping me all this time. You know, they always got away and I got the whip. And this was the story of my life. Everybody else got away and I was responsible for it. So I was into alcoholism too. I just didn't know it. Couldn't handle that. I have to tell you, I couldn't handle that homebrew that morning. They all got away on their own two legs and I'm laying stretched out by the homebrew. And on down the line, I never could handle the booze. I was out of control of my mouth when I took two drinks, and I'm grateful for that, because with my addictive nature, I'd have been an alcoholic, and y'all would have had a bunch of stuff to work on. Probably wouldn't have helped either. I grew up in this small town. I learned a lot of things in this small town. I learned love of God, love of country, and love of fellow man here, and I'm grateful. You can't have much better upbringing than this. When I finished high school, I came away from this. I'd worked all through high school, and I came away to go to work someplace else. Now, I learned one thing while I learned to be a real good swinger. I loved the dim lights, the loud music, and the honky-tonks. I wasn't far from a whole bunch of soldiers in Selma, Alabama. And, you know, that we were all having a swinging good time, dancing and big band sounds, and loved people. I got high on people, just loved to be in a crowd of people. But I learned I couldn't drink. I just have to drink maybe one or two drinks, and then I sort of get flaked out over in the corner, and my mouth was stopped, and I'm sure everybody was glad. But I was out of control, and I never like to be out of control. And anyway, I came to Birmingham, and I was certainly found a playmate. He had some money, and he liked the big band sounds, and he liked to spend money, and he liked to go where the crowds was, and so we had a ball for a little while. I'm sure he was drinking the first time I ever saw him. I know he was drinking when we married. He had 6 years of sobriety before he died. I got to get this in right quick, right? Grateful for that. Thank you, AAs, for that. Credit belongs to you, but not to me. But pretty soon after I started dating him, he took me by his family's home to meet the family. I've been dating him very long. The cutest little blue-eyed, golden-haired girl snuggled up real close between me and I on the couch, and she said, "Will you marry us?" This was a child by his first marriage, and of course, I wanted to be, you know, I just came to help everybody out. That's the story of my life. I'm just helping anybody that needs to be helped out. So I married them. She and I have been married almost 45 years, and I'm grateful for this love. 5 years after we were married, we had another daughter, and we have 4 grandchildren, and I have a great-grandson out of this union. I'm grateful for this. I always told what good in-laws I had to everybody. They were overjoyed that Fred and I were married. You see, I take 2 people out of his mother's house, and they just jumping for joy. Fred was 19 years old when this child was born, and he brought her back to his mother, and she raised a little girl and a little boy, and who was 19 years old. So, of course, they were delighted for me to take these people away from this house. And that started a havoc between 2 people. I have been a controller all my life by nature, and this was one of my survival skills, and I was going to control this man into being what I wanted him to be. See, I hadn't seen much of this drinking because I hadn't dated him very long, and he was well fortified when we got where we was going, and we would go to the nightclubs, and I would get up and leave my drink on the table, and he'd go back immediately and drink it. I didn't think anything about that, you know. I just thought he was tight with his money and didn't want to waste the drink. Little did I know that he was always fortified before he got there. This is my story, so I need to leave him at rest. I started out to be the best mother in the whole world. Somehow it never occurred to me to be the best wife. Somewhere down the line, he went his way and I went my way. He was a social drinker, and he continued to socialize. Now, I never did like the ladies of the evening that he socialized with in the evening and at 9 and whenever else he decided to socialize with them. And sometime I went into these dives, and I cleaned them out. And they got to know me, and they left, you know, when I came in there. Now, I'm a big church worker, but all the dives was right in the shadow of the church, you know, so I go down to clean the dives out because he's in the dives. This walked on this way for a very long time. Our oldest daughter married, and I have been told to tell some stories this morning, and I just will have to tell them to show you how sick I was. Came time for the youngest daughter to marry, and by this time, I had realized that I had to get out of this mess somewhere or other, so something came to me last night, and I shared this, that I left home with an empty suitcase. And I never put a thing in it. And one morning, I remember walking down the street in front of my house at 2 o'clock in the morning with an empty suitcase, and I live in Birmingham. It's a high crime rate city up there, as y'all know. It wasn't quite this bad 20 years ago, but the police stopped me and said, "Lady, where are you going?" And I probably cussed him out. I don't remember. And he got out to help me go back home. I showed him I lived, and the suitcase came open. Not a thing in it. I've often wondered what he thought. He did get me back to my front porch. I realized leaving was not the answer. To tell you the truth, I didn't have any place to go. Nobody wanted me, and nobody wanted me to be around them, so I didn't have any place to go. So I stayed. I wanted to stay, really, and I stayed. The youngest daughter got married. By this time, it is full-blown alcoholism and full-blown reaction to the disease of alcoholism. And if you do not believe that alcoholism is a family disease, you have not lived in it as many years as I lived in it. It is a family disease. It affects all members of the family. You know, I didn't like the clerks at the grocery store. I didn't like the doctor's office receptionist. I didn't like my family. I didn't like my kids. I didn't like him. I didn't like anybody, and I told you so. He was pleasant to everybody. Even drunk, he was pleasant to everybody. I was the one that reacted and being mad all the time. This daughter came up to get married, but in the meantime, I had taken a job. I got to tell you this. I'd taken a job. Everybody that is in Al-Anon and reacting, everybody that is living in alcoholism and reacting needs a job. Now, you don't need a job that does not pay you anything. They need to give you $1 an hour or something, just enough to, you know, make yourself worth a little bit. So I went out to ask for a job and took a job and never asked them how much they were going to pay me. That was my first mistake, and I worked for them 20 years, and I never asked them. I fought for every raise I got, and they'd say, you never asked us how much we was going to pay you when you came here. I must have been making all of $3 an hour when this wedding came up. I should have known something, because two or three days before the wedding, he was trying to come off this drink, and so I locked him up in the downstairs den in the basement. Somebody nodding their head back there. I locked the door on the outside so he couldn't get out. There are casement windows in this down in the basement, in the den. The party was going pretty well upstairs. The wedding party was going pretty well upstairs, and the doorbell rang. One of the kids went to the door, and Fred said, "Hi, come on in, Mr. Stewart." I'm back there. If I could find a butcher knife, I'd probably chop his head off. And this was the first thing that led me to do the next thing, which made a lot of sense to me, and Al-Anons are going to agree with me. I decided, see, he's drinking. The wedding's a few days off. He's not in the remorseful period. He's not in the hungover period. And I got to do something. Time's fast closing in on me. So I did the logical thing that any good mother would do. I called up Birch and Tan and ordered 5 tuxedos, added to the already tuxedos that the wedding party had, and they said, "What size?" And I said, "Just any size." So I was going to take care of this because it was relatives here, there, and everywhere that was coming into this wedding. My son-in-law, number one, went up to pick up these 2 or 3 days before the wedding to pick up these tuxedos, and he called me back and he said, "Ruth, there's something I don't understand up here, and the man is very animate about me bringing them." Said, "There's 5 extra tuxedos of all different sizes." And I said, "Bring them on, Charles, and don't ever mention this to me again. If Fred's too drunk, one of them belongs to whoever's coming into town this day." So I had 5 extra tuxedos. Now, Alan Munns, that makes sense to you, doesn't it? Because if he's too drunk, you're going to put somebody in, you're going to walk down the line with somebody. Didn't seem like strange behavior to me. The son-in-law started, when he questioned it, it began to sound a little strange. But what I was trying to do was not let him know how much I was spending on this wedding, him being Fred. He never asked what I spent anyway. It was me being secretive. I said, "Don't worry about it. I'll pay for it. I'm making $3 an hour." And I didn't tell him that. I'm making $3 an hour, and these tuxedos went for about $50. I'm talking about 20 years ago, So you can imagine where this left me. Insanity really does set in. Things are fast getting insane at our house now. I don't even know what time it is. Things are fast getting... I wonder if that's God sending me a message. I always ask to get honest when I get up there. Is that it? Oh, man. Things are fast coming to a close in our family. The kids just left home. My mother moved in with us in this nice home that we were running. And she stayed for about 14 years. And she decided she'd leave. And I thought, well, how dare Mama leave this nice home? Why, it's comfortable, it's quiet. What she went off and told was that Fred does drink a little too much, but Ruth is crazy. I'm her daughter. Well, another wedding in the family. Not in our family, but down around New Orleans, and that's where we spent our honeymoon, and he was, we were down in the French Quarters at a later time, if I forget to tell it, and he was walking around looking at all the things in the French Quarters and pointing these things out to me as if he had never seen them before, and it dawned on me he hadn't. He was sober. He'd never seen them before. Been in there lots and lots of times. We went to a Cajun wedding. Our nephew was marrying a Cajun girl down in Cameron, Louisiana. If you've never been to a Cajun wedding, you never have lived. Don't go now. You might get drunk again. Stay away from home. We were down there for a long time, for a week, getting them married. Ryan ran big automobiles, and he was in his glory. The champagne was flowing, the booze was flowing, and he was in his glory. He's trying to keep this buzz on because, you see, we were going back to Money Grow down in New Orleans on our way back home. And we did. We had our youngest daughter and her husband. They were in the wedding, the wedding we went to, so they were with us, and they were driving and taking care of us. I'm going to talk to Franklin later and find out where this place in Mississippi is because I've forgotten. We were coming back from New Orleans and Sunday afternoon, and Fred was on hungover and slumped over on the back seat of the car, and I'm on the back seat up at him, About this time, son-in-law number 2's driving, and about this time the siren went off right behind us. local police. They said, pull over, you're speeding. So I raised up and I said, well, of course he's not speeding. And I had not even looked at the speedometer. And I said a few words to him, and he said, you can pay the ticket now, or we'll take you into the Justice of Peace. We just crossed over from Louisiana into the Mississippi territory, coming home. It was on a Sunday afternoon, and I couldn't stand to not talk, so I started talking, and they took us into this little old small place in a very small town. I told them we'd just come in and pay the ticket. I had no idea I was going to out-talk. I was going to do something to the man when I got there, and I really did. Went in down this in February, and there was a pot-bellied stove there, and the justice of the peace chewed a little bit of tobacco, and then he spat on that stove, and I told you Mama raised a lady, and it sizzled when it hit that stove, and I told him off. And he said something to me, and he spit back again, and I told him what a lady I was, and that we weren't speeding, and the speeding ticket was $16, and somewhere in this confrontation between this justice and peace and me, he looked over at Fred, and he said, is this your wife? And Fred said, it is, and he said, stop her from talking, I'm going to find her from contempt of court or whatever it was he was doing, and he said, I've never been able to stop her talking, you see what you can do. I talked $168. First time I have been paid for talking in my life. Started off with a $16 ticket and ended up with a $168 ticket. And I'm cold sober, John. Cold sober. That's what happened. It was fast getting to a close there. There's one more, then I'm going to get on to recovery. Told you I took a job. He decided that everybody needed to retire at 55 years old, and he would retire. Well, I didn't have any control over him. He'd worked 37 and a half years at this place, so he decided to retire. I have looked back over it. I'm sure they were about to fire him, but he never admitted it, even in his sobriety, and taking inventories after he'd gone. But I was working my job, and he went off. He said, I'm going to buy a new car before I retire. Fine with me. I live in the western section of Birmingham, right off of I-59. He was going over to the eastern section of the city to buy a car. It's all of 11 miles as the crow flies. He was gone 3 days and 2 nights to buy a car. Didn't get back home. But, you know, I went on to work during this period of time. And I would come home. I can't tell you that I was not antsy when I came home. And I can't tell you that I was not anxious and that I cussed and vamped to myself. Nobody was living with me then. Nobody much came around me then. He called me one time during that time and wanted to know what color car I wanted. And I said, well, I would like a blue. I had to tell him something I knew was wrong. So I just left it at that. The second night after he'd been gone so long, the doorbell rang at 1 o'clock in the morning, and two teenage boys down the street from me said, Mr., we brought Mr. Sturt home. And when I opened the doorbell to greet him, that's what they said to me, and there standing between them was Fred. He said, hi, honey. Like he had just gone, just like he'd gone out and come back in. One of the boys said to me, Mr., do y'all have a new car? And I said, I don't. And I didn't. I had the old one. And he said, there's a gold Chevrolet Impala with its nose headed down in, right at the corner down here at the light, with its nose headed down in this ditch. And that's where we found Mr. Stewart. Said, the car doesn't look like it's hurt very much. And I said, oh, I thank you for bringing him home. I was just so gracious to those two boys. I closed the door, and when they turned him loose, he fell. And I closed the door, and I said, oh, boy, I've got you where I want you now. I had wanted to fight him so long for so many times that I didn't. But this night, I kicked him all over the living room floor into the dining room, and I went to bed and went to sleep because I had not slept all the time he was out buying a car. I'm working, and he's out buying a car. I wasn't in Al-Anon at this time, so I stopped down at the corner and opened the door to the car to see what was inside it, expecting to find one of his girls of the evening, perhaps. There was less than 50 miles on this automobile. There was 3 tickets to the Birmingham Police Department. He had been in jail and out. He had been picked up for jaywalking to the liquor store somewhere downtown in Birmingham. And it was another one that I wasn't familiar with. He was driving with it. Didn't even have a tag. Didn't have a thing in the world on this car. So I closed the door of the car, and I left the tickets, and I went to work. I don't know what he did about this, and it got to be a real touchy subject several years later down the road, and I never really got to discuss this too much with his reaction. 2 or 3 days later, I came in from work one afternoon, and he said, I didn't do very much harm to the car. Said I took it back over to Richard Kelly's Chevrolet, and there's very little wrong with it. But he said, I am black and blue all over. Said, the wheel's not even broken. And I said, Some of this smart aleck bunch up and down the Gulf Coast heard about this story, and we'd been over here one night. I'd been talking over here at Fort Walton and some of their groups over here, and he came with me. This was after he'd maintained a few months and maybe a year or so of sobriety. And I said, okay, God, that's why I thought God was talking to me just now before I got up there. Okay, God, keep me honest. And somebody said, tell that story. And I got up and I told that story. How far is it from here to Panama City? 50 miles. I tell you, I thought he was going to quit me. I'll get a divorce about this. How dare I kick him? How dare I kick him? You know, there's a little bit more to this story that comes to me a lot of times as I tell it. A few months after that, he didn't know I had beat him up at this time. It was well down the line. The same gold Chevrolet Impala. He said to me, we need to cut corners now that I've retired. I think we can do without one automobile. We'll just have one automobile. And I've always been people pleasing. I said, that's fine. I envisioned driving car. 2 weeks I walked and he drove. Nobody came by and picked me up or anything. So one day I said, this has got to end. You know, I used a lot of flowery language back then, and I'm grateful that God took all this language away from me. I didn't want to give it to him, but he took it anyway, and I'm grateful. So I'll now express it like this. I was tired of walking. So I made one last walking trip, and I walked down to the Datsun place and bought me an orange-colored Datsun, and some of you remember my station wagon. It was just a wee little old thing, and I drove it home, and I parked it in the front yard in the driveway. He had to park in the back driveway, and he came riding up in his big, fine automobile, and he said, who's Japanese junk? Junk is that out there? He's U.S. Steel man, born bred U.S. Steel. Didn't want any Japanese junk around him. I said, that's mine, and keep your hands off of it. I'm being nice. That's the same gold Chevrolet that I tell you about. He did keep his hands off my car. I am grateful now that I can tell you some of my recovery. I know that you'd think that a lady like me did not do these things, but I can tell you, there's a lot more that are worse than this. I've just sort of cleaned it up a little bit. He was a gentleman. He didn't talk back to me. He never fought back at me. And if I'd have kept my mouth shut, there would have been more peace and serenity in that family. One of my youngest daughters said to me, Mother, it's obvious that Daddy's alcoholic. He's always drunk with a bottle. And I added the open checkbook. She said, that's why. But what's wrong with you? I was trying to pay the bills and keep everything going and keep everything together, and he was drunk and giving the money away to the kids. A lot of things was wrong with me. It was, when I came in Al-Anon, I heard this phrase. So I made it to Al-Anon, I made it to you people, and I've been here 18 years, and I'm grateful for this. I'm a slow learner. I didn't recover fast. I'm grateful that I'm still here because we recover one day at a time. We made it back to this meeting I spoke of a few moments ago. And to his credit, he was at AA meetings when he was sober in his group. And there must be 200 years or more of sobriety in the Western group in the city of Birmingham. And that's where he was. They always greeted him back and said, welcome back. I started Al-Anon, and I soaked it up like a sponge. I liked everything you told me. I didn't think you was very smart. I was still a smart aleck. I brought a lot of these survival skills in with me. And if you don't watch me today, I use some of my money. Al-Anon's up, you know, they're on to me. They don't let me do this much. I started to my meetings, and he went to his. And I volunteered for everything they would let me volunteer for. And 5 years into this program, I was down at Area Assembly doing Area Assembly work, and he loved Area Assembly also. He liked the business part of AA, and he would go down there and represent his group at times when nobody else could go. And we were at the old Madison Hotel, where we're going to move back to in next year, right, January. And Fred took drunk on me down at area assembly. And, you know, I knew why I took drunk, and I told several people why I took drunk, because if y'all remember, those of you who went to area assembly, the bar was right across from your meeting room. And I said he couldn't get by the bar. He drank because he wanted to. Well, we stayed down there several times, and I didn't tell anybody about this. I didn't, except just a very few people that I talked to. You see, I was in Al-Anon, and I was saying, did you hear that? Did you hear this talk? Aren't you going to AA tonight? You haven't been to AA in 2 or 3 months, or 2 or 3 weeks. He never stayed 2 or 3 months. Yeah, and controlling his life. When are you going to get up and give an AA talk? I'll help you write it. Now, I'm in Al-Anon. I know some of you know what I'm talking about. 5 years into this program, they took me by the hand and said, you've got to detach. Now, I came into this program and I heard, love, 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 love. Love's the answer. What's your problem? I turned him over to God and I left him. God wouldn't take him. I didn't want him. It's okay. Didn't work that way for me. Maybe it worked that way for you, and I am grateful, but it didn't work that way for me. I had to walk through a lot of pain before I was ever able to gain any amount of serenity. There's so many people in this room that would put their arms around me and say, you know, you got to change. And I'd say, I'm not changing anymore. It's time for him to change. Well, it was the AAs that was telling me to change. Of course, I knew I had to change, and I knew somebody had to change. Well, somebody died in that family. I heard on an AA talk that night, I went in area assembly. I went on down to the speaker's meeting, and it was an AA man, and I heard more than I've ever heard any other AA speak and talk and be associated with from up in my area. And he simply said to the AAs that night, you drink because you want to. If you didn't want to, you wouldn't drink. I believed this for the first time. Stopped an AA girlfriend of mine out in the hall, and I said, they tell me I got to detach, and she's from Atlanta, Georgia, and she uses flower language, and I don't talk about her either. And I said, I don't know anything about detach. And she said, well, hell, you talk about it all the time, and Al-Anon released with love. And I said, I don't love him. She said, tell God he died. Kill him and tell God he died. And I said, I like it, I like it, I like it. She didn't express it exactly like that. I had wanted to do this for a long time. I had to detach myself from him. And I'm using the word detach, and it's my talk, and I will use it. It means release, and it means you can do it any way you can. If you love them, you'll go back to loving them later. You just do whatever you have to do to get out of the situation. If you can release with love, that's a ladylike way to do it. They told me a lot of things that I had to do in order to maintain the quality of Al-Anon that I saw in other people, and I had this big, big problem. Everybody had big diamond rings and Lincoln Continentals in the basement group, and I kept sitting there saying, one day we're going to have a Lincoln Continental and a diamond ring. Whenever they get it. The basement group knows I talk. You know, they just said, I never saw so many diamond rings on men's fingers. I kept thinking we'd get this, and I was looking at your outside. I didn't know about your inside. And my inside didn't look like your outside. This is what I need to work on most in my life, is my insides matching my outsides. And I come to realize that I had to release and let him go. They told me that first off I had to tell him I loved him, and I said, I don't love him. I said, don't make any difference. You fake it till you make it. And I told this over at a meeting the other night, and it was a bunch of young girls just had a ball with it. They're going out and trying to fake it till they make it. But we used to use this phrase real often in the old timers, and I still think it works, you know. You can smile, you can be pleasant, and you can say, I love you. He didn't believe it, and I didn't believe it. But I would go in the front door, and I'd put my purse down. I'm still in this fine job, and I put my purse down. And I said, after I tell him that I love him, what am I supposed to do? Well, you're stupid. You know, they said to me, you're stupid. You do the things you're supposed to do. I'm still taking his inventory, doing the things he's supposed to do, not looking at me. And they said, I don't know how to do it. And I said, okay, that you take the first 3 steps of Al-Anon every morning when you arrive, simply like this. And I took them this morning, looking at the beach. And this fine chairman locked me out while I was out meditating on this talk, and that's probably why it's this way. She locked me out, and I'm on the balcony. It's raining on me. John and Pigeon vouch for that. This is the way I really take those first three steps of Al-Anon. Good morning, God. This is Ruth. My life is unmanageable. I know I don't control alcohol. I don't control the ads on the TV. I don't control any of the friends that's drinking. I never controlled the man I was married to. So I know I'm out of control there. And the second step, restore me to the right kind of thinking. And the Alateens told me, no big problem. You know you're crazy when you get here. Just ask God to restore you to the right kind of thinking. Probably came from Kitty's kids over here. I listened to everybody that told me these things. Fantastic international convention, most of us know. And we came back to the little beach house. And he was painting the sign or refurbishing it, maybe, Jim, I don't remember which. But it had it rolled out all the way across the trailer, and it said, love and be loved. And the doctor called and said, Fred, you need to get back to Birmingham. He said, this CAT scan revealed that you have bone cancer. We need you back real soon to start treatments. And he made a couple of Al-Anon AA calls, and I made a couple of Al-Anon calls, and we went back. 2 years and 9 months of cancer that he and I lived with. The Al-Anons kept me straight. The AAs kept him straight, and every day I'd say to myself, I don't know why he don't drink today. He's got an excuse to drink, you know. He didn't. For 2 years and 9 months, you brought the program to me. For 2 years and 9 months, you brought the program to him. The last trip he made to the Gulf Coast Roundup was 1982 in November. And he served about one day in the coffee room. And I'm so grateful this was the last trip he made. This was not the last time he saw you Gulf Coast Roundup people, though, because you came up in February to convention and we had a meeting out of our house. That's the way this program works. I'm so grateful for it. He's been dead 7 years, and I have a lot of freedom to do the things I want to do in my life today, and I choose to remain this way. I want to tell you, unless you question me, I haven't had my door beaten down by these rich 40-year-old men wanting in, you know, to marry me or anything. I've just had a ball since I have been free to do the things I need to do, and I'm still in this program. I never left my program, and I went back to my home group. And I said, 1 week after he was gone, I said, well, people, you know, my brothers had said, we don't need to go back to that program anymore, and you don't need to do this, that, and other. So I went back to my group, and I said, well, I guess I won't be back anymore. And they pushed the chairs back from the table. This is the same folks that spent 2 days and two nights sitting with me during this funeral and never did a thing except just sit there and support me. And I say this to them, and they pushed the chairs back, and they told me exactly what I needed to hear. So I've been in Al-Anon ever since. 3 times a week it takes to keep me straight. I'm grateful for this. It is a recovering program. If you're out there this morning and you're living in active alcoholism, or if you're out there this morning and you want to change some of the character defects you have, believe you me, just putting in the cork in the bottle is not going to hack it for most of us Al-Anon fellas. Get on with changing some of these character defects, because that's what we work on in Al-Anon. And you know, just because you're married to an alcoholic does not mean that you're an Al-Anon. You got to go through pain before you can have the gain. You've got to study these steps. You've got to walk this walk. You've got to talk this talk. You've got to be available day and night for this program. That's what Al-Anon is all about. And, you know, I'm grateful to be into this program this many years. I'm grateful for the... I'm overwhelmed with gratitude at this Gulf Coast Roundup. And I just said, Lord, please don't let me cry. I'm not a cryer. I don't want to cry. I'm so pretty. I don't want to mess my face up. So I just, you know, I just could get up here and cry about all the faces I see out there. And I see a couple of my old buddies back over in the corner that came in late. I'm grateful for that. I could just, you know, I could come down and talk to almost everyone of me on a personal basis over in this area and feel good about it this morning. But this is the way that I choose to spend most of my days now. I have an open Al-Anon house. We have Al-Anon all night and all day sometime, and just do a lot of things up at my house. And I make all these roundups, and I do a lot of things. And I'm grateful that 18 years ago that I came and I stayed. It hasn't always been easy. It's not an easy program, but it has been most fulfilling for me. I want to thank you. I want to tell you that I love you and I feel your love. And I want to say one other thing. Don't walk in front of me. I will not follow. Don't walk behind me. I will not lead. Just walk beside me and be my friend. I thank you.